Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Daniel Gordas, president of the Shalem Foundation in New York City, and senior fellow at the Shalem Center in Jerusalem, as well as the author of Saving Israel, How the Jewish People Can Win a War That May Never End. He'll speak on the topic, The Year 2048, Can Israel Survive to the Age of 100? Dr. Gordas' remarks were given as part of the Ruth and Phil Sokoloff Lecture Series. His appearance was co-sponsored by the Natan and Hannah Schwab Center for Israel and Jewish Studies. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, November 16, 2011, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the University of Nebraska at Omaha, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce a speaker is Guy Matalon, the director of the Natan and Hannah Schwab Center for Israel and Jewish Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha.
Rabbi Dr. Daniel Gordas is widely cited on matters relating to Israel and has written and lectured throughout the world on Israeli society and difficulties facing the Jewish state. He is a regular columnist for the Jerusalem Post, and his writings have appeared in a wide array of magazines and newspapers, including the New York Times, the New Republic, the New York Times Magazine, Moment, Tikkun Azer, Commentary Magazine, Foreign Affairs, and Conservative Judaism. As well as being a frequent contributor to these publications, he is also the author of numerous books, including Saving Israel, How the Jewish People Can Win a War That May Never End, which was published in 2009 and awarded the 2009 National Jewish Book Award. So with that, without further ado, please welcome our distinguished speaker, Rabbi Dr. Daniel Gordas.
Thank you very much, Dr. Matalon, for the lovely introduction. In any event, it's really a great honor to be in Omaha. As some of you know, I have a very, very close, longtime friend in Joel Alperson and his wife, Daphna, so to be able to see them in their hometown is also a great honor. But it's a wonderful community, and I haven't been here for a very, very long time, so I'm really very gratified and honored by the invitation to be part of this extraordinary series, part of the Schwab Center, and it's really just a great honor to be here, and I thank you. What is Israel really about? I mean, why do we need it? And I want to try to divide this up into a couple of different sections, and then we can pursue it a little bit more in the question and answer period. But let me first begin by suggesting the following thought experiment. Imagine that it's now January 1946. It's not November 2011, but it's January 1946. And you are exactly who you are, educated, intelligent, literate, learned, reasonably sane. And somebody says to you, tell me about the future of the Jews. So you look around the world. And what do you actually see? So you start in Eastern Europe, and you see actually nothing. Because the idea that Hitler killed a third of the world's Jews completely and utterly misses the point. It's an irrelevant number. The important number is 90%. The important number is that what Nazi Germany and its allies, quote unquote, destroyed during the years of the Shoah was 90% of Eastern Europe's Jewry. There was about 4 million Jews in Poland when the war started. There were about 300,000 when the war was over. There's 10,000 now. And they weren't buried. They went up to the sky in smokestacks, the vast majority of them. Most of them, by the way, relatively late. So you look to Eastern Europe in January 1946 and you see nothing. You see a void. I was just in Poland not that long ago, a couple months ago. And the thing about Poland that's devastating even now in 2011 is you go from town to town to town, and each one has a little museum of the Jews. But the curators of the towns, of course, are Gentiles, because there are no Jews. Not a few Jews. There are no Jews. Because as many of you know, the few who survived the camps who went back to their towns were often murdered by the people who were there, who had watched as they were trucked away. And we could go over, this is not a talk about the Shoah, about the Holocaust, but nonetheless, if you're sitting in 1946, January 46, and somebody says, tell me about the future of the Jews, and you look over to Eastern Europe, it's gone. It's vaporized. It's absent. It's empty. There's a few Jews left. And they are living in what is now called the Soviet Union. And if you had a crystal ball, you would know that their lives were going to get infinitely worse long before they started to get better. So then you shift your sights towards Central and Western Europe, and you see that there is a community there not entirely murdered, but traumatized nonetheless. Because French Jews knew that the Germans did not actually have to go into French cities to collect the Jews. They simply handed a number over to the gendarme. And you, like you and I, in fourth grade, to answer that extra question for extra credit, they turned over more Jews than was actually required. You knew that in Saloniki, they turned over every single solitary Jew. There wasn't one left. And the Nazis didn't have to round anybody up. Jews of obviously, England were completely traumatized because they'd survived the war the way all other Englishmen had survived the war, and the Blitz and so on and so forth is not good there either. Then you look across the Atlantic, and there's this country called the United States of America, which I want to assure you, from a Jewish point of view, looks nothing like what you take for granted in Omaha, Nebraska in 2011. Nothing. Not remotely anything like this. Because the Jews in America in January 1946 were coming to terms with the fact that they had basically known throughout the war what was going on. They didn't have the graphic movies. They didn't have all the details. They didn't have all the history books. But it was in the New York Times. It was in the New York Times. Deborah Lipstadt has proved this beyond the shadow of a doubt in her book called Beyond Belief. And there are many other books that have documented this as well. All the details that we have now? No. All the photographs that we have now? No. Did they know? Yes. And here's the question. How many buses of people from anywhere on the Northeast Corridor or anywhere in the country, and there were millions of Jews in the United States back then, millions. How many busloads went to the steps of Capitol Hill between 1938 and 1945 to go to their congressmen, congresswomen, of whom there weren't that many back then, and senators, and to demand that something be done, either bomb the tracks to Auschwitz or open up the shores of this country, which, as you know, did not allow boats of refugees to dock. And so they turned away and went either to Cuba or to Argentina or to the bottom of the ocean in some cases. How many busloads of Jews actually went to Washington, D.C. during those years of the war to demand that something happen? They were individuals. But this year, and you can be a big fan of AIPAC or not as big a fan of AIPAC, it doesn't matter for this conversation. But this year when AIPAC has 14,000 people at its annual policy conference, and on the third day of the conference, the vast majority of them go to Capitol Hill to speak to their representatives, 14,000 people in a time when, despite all the problems that we face, Israel is a thriving country, and nobody's killing Jews, and nobody has closed any borders. Things are actually okay. And things were not okay in 1938 to 1945. How many Jews went to Capitol Hill? Virtually none. So in 1946, American Jews are staring directly down at the floor. And then there's another population of Jews across the ocean. Once again, it's in a place called Palestine. But if you want to go there, it's a little bit tricky because there's tens of thousands of British troops patrolling the shores of Palestine. By the way, tens of thousands of British troops who'd been there all throughout the war, who were not stationed in the European theater where they could have done some good. But they were there to make sure that the demographic balance didn't get changed. And that country is, you know, desperate to have statehood, but it's not so clear. The British say they're not going anywhere. So it's January 1946, and somebody says to you, tell me about the future of the Jews. The only rational conclusion that you can draw is that the best days of the Jewish people were in the past. It's the only logical conclusion. The Jews aren't done for, but they are badly, badly battered. Now, I ask you to compare what you could have imagined in January 1946 to what you actually see in November 2011, where they close West End Avenue on the Upper West Side of New York on Simchat Torah so Jews can dance with Torahs, where occasionally they hire people without kippot on Madison Avenue, where Jews have become entirely accepted and very successful. And like every community that's successful, people who do very good things, some people who do very bad things, we're normal in that regard, sometimes wonderfully so and sometimes shamefully so. But you would not have imagined the kind of flourishing that you have in New York, that you have in Los Angeles, that you have in Boston, that you have, by the way, in Berlin, which is the fastest growing Jewish community anywhere in Europe, that you have in Warsaw, which is experiencing, for example, the Jewish cultural arts revival with everything that that entails except for Jews. No, it's being done by non-Jews, but a huge cultural arts revival of the Jews. You would not have imagined anything that we have. And I want to suggest to you that it's not an accident that we have it, because it's a result of the State of Israel. And it did not begin to be in 1947 when they voted in the UN, and it did not begin to be in May 1948 when they declared independence, and it did not begin to be in 1949 when the war gradually ended, or in 56. The turning point is 1967. It is in 1967 when American Jews begin to come out of the woodwork. It is in 1967 when it's also a product of other kinds of things. But there's the whole Chavura movement. Some of you may remember that the Jewish catalogs, those what for them was blockbuster sales for Jewish Publication Society books, came out, written out by Michael and Sharon Strassfeld, which brought kind of a popularization of Judaism and Jewish ritual to a whole new generation of people. There was the Whole Earth Catalog that some people know about. This was kind of the Jewish version of that. There was the Chavura movement, as I mentioned, the beginning of Soviet Jewry. The movement to free Soviet Jewry is a post-June 1967 movement. Because Soviet Jews heard about what was going on in the Middle East. They heard about it, by the way, in Pravda, which announced it and reported on it reasonably accurately in certain cases. And they said, that we want to be a part of. That's a different kind of Jew. We want to be part of that. What the Jewish people did, in a sense, is to transform the iconic image of what it meant to be a Jew from one famous photograph to another. Let me explain. In 1946, in January 1946, when we're doing our little experiment, or mind experiment, and I'd said to you, tell me about the future of the Jews, and you'd answered your question, and then I'd said to you, now tell me one image, you know, some photographic, iconic image of what it means to be a Jew. The photograph that the vast majority of you would have picked is that little boy in the Warsaw ghetto with his hands in the air, wearing his, you know, little jacket, and he's got those black socks up to his knee, and there's a Nazi pointing a gun, not directly at him, but vaguely in his general direction. That's what it meant to be a Jew. To be a Jew meant to be a victim on call. It meant to be, you're the victim, we'll let you know when we need you. That's what it meant. By the way, that little boy's parents had moved to Palestine in the 1930s and didn't like it and moved back. He survived, amazingly enough, but that's another story for a different night. But in July 1967, a month after the war was over, if I asked you, tell me a photograph that now embodies for you what it means to be a Jew, the photograph that you would have picked was not that little boy with his hands in the air in the Warsaw ghetto. The photograph would have been those three paratroopers standing shoulder to shoulder in front of the Kotel, in front of the Western Wall. And the difference between that little boy with his hands in the air and the three paratroopers standing next to each other embodies or encapsulates exactly the transformation in the self-perception of Jews all over the world, including behind the Iron Curtain, and certainly including the United States, and absolutely including Israel, because Israel actually had transformed the existential condition of what it meant to be a Jew. It was because of the war in 1967 that Jews all of a sudden did not see themselves any longer as being victims on call. There's a gun in the Warsaw Ghetto picture, and it's pointed at the Jew, and it's held by a Nazi. There are no guns in the Western Wall picture, but if there had been, you know very well who would have been holding them. There's a soldier in the first picture, it's a Nazi. There's three soldiers in the second picture, Jews. The Jew in the first picture is a victim. The three Jews in the second picture are victors. The first one is this frail little boy with his hands frightfully in the air, and the second one is three guys in their 20s at the prime of their life, built and in shape, just having hours earlier captured the Western Wall from the Jordanians. It's two entirely opposite existential conditions. And fundamentally, that's what Israel has done. Israel has filled the Jewish people with the belief that it can actually have a different existential condition. It's not an accident that Israel's anthem is called Hatikva, which means hope. Right? It's called the hope. That's the name of Israel's anthem. Because that's the business that Israel's in. I know you had Dan Senor here last year, so you heard that Israel's in the high-tech business. That's also true, absolutely. But the fundamental business that Israel's in is in the business of hope. And what Israel has done is it has re-injected the Jewish people with a sense of hope and optimism about the future. Did the Jewish people ever lose it entirely? Obviously not. Is it the only thing that's invested the Jewish people with hope? Obviously not. Has it played the major role? It has. That's the fundamental first thing that needs to be said when we talk about what it is that Israel has done for the Jewish people. It has invested the Jewish people in a sense, with a sense that there is a hopeful future, not a depressed future. A second part of it, which is related, and I'll do it very quickly because we already mentioned it, is that Israel really created a new Jew. There was a sense after the Second World War, which had already begun at the beginning of the 20th century, when Chaim Nachman Bialik, for example, who was really the poet laureate of the Jewish people during his life till he died in 1934 in Vienna, even though he lived in Palestine, he went to Vienna for medical treatment, which was not successful. But Chaim Nachman Bialik was the poet laureate of the Jewish people, already by the turn of the century. And he is sent in 1904 to Kishinev, where there had been a terrible pogrom, to go see what was there and to write about it. He ended up writing really one of his great works, a long, long, long poem called Be'ir HaHarega, The City of Slaughter. And what Chaim Nachman Bialik wrote about is, you know, he kind of does it as a docent. He takes you here, he takes you there, he shows you this, he shows you that. And at one point, he takes you to the basement of a house. Now, it's all fictional, but it's graphic. And it's graphic for a reason. So perhaps the greatest living poet of the Jewish people at the beginning of the 20th century writes this poem and says, "Come now to the cellar." And he describes how during the attack, the Jewish men hid behind casks, slotted casks of whatever they were, while in front of them, their wives, their sisters, their mothers, and their daughters are raped by this gang of Cossacks. And then Bialik, with a sharp tongue, the way that only a great poet can, says that when the horrible attack is over and the marauding men, if you can call them that, leave, the Jewish men, if you can call them that, step out from behind the casks, step over the bodies of their wives and their daughters and their sisters and their mothers, and the Kohanim, those of the priestly class among them, run to the rabbi's house and ask, "Tell me, Rabbi, is my wife still permitted to me?" Because in Jewish law, there is a rule that if a Kohen is married to a woman who has sexual relations with another man, then he can no longer sleep with her. So there's now this technical, halachic, Jewish legal question. But that obviously never happened. But what's Bialik's point in making up a story like that? He's saying that what Judaism has become in Europe by the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, it is literally a cancer. It is destroying you, Bialik says. Do you see that you can't defend yourselves? He calls them, laughingly, the sons of the Maccabees. He says, this is the sons of the Maccabees? The Maccabees who defeated the Greeks, and you're hiding behind the casks? And forget the fact that you're not strong enough to win. You don't even have the courage to try. So you got killed defending your wife. That's okay. The only thing that's not okay is to hide. And then, okay, so you have no muscle, and you have no courage. And then you step out because they're gone, and you go to the rabbi? So you have no soul either. You're not human. You're this little automaton that wants to know, is it time to do shacharit? Is it time to do mincha? Do I put my tefillin on this way? Do I put my tefillin on that way? Is this animal kosher? Is this animal not kosher? Who cares, says Bialik. Understand me, I care a lot about those things. But he says, who cares? If that's how you think of the world, you're not human anymore. And what has dehumanized you is Judaism. There was a recognition that the yeshiva bachur style of Judaism that had been Europe's for so long was failing. Nordau wrote about this. Lots of people wrote about this, not just Bialik. And here's something else that has invested the Jewish people with a tremendous sense of pride. It's not only that od lo avdati kvatenu, our hope is not yet lost, and sovereignty. There is a new kind of Jew. Another thing that Israel has done for the Jewish people, which is also related, but it's also a little bit dissimilar, is that part of what Israel has done is it has restored the Jewish people to the family of nations who helped determine the course of history. If I were to give you a list of peoples, the French, the Italians, the Spanish, the Chechens, the Tibetans, and the Basques. Now, they all have certain things in common. They all have languages. They all have religious traditions. They all have, historical narratives. They all have culinary traditions. They all have musical traditions. They all have histories. I mean, they are all of them rich traditions. But if I said to you, if you had two of those index cards left, write three of them on one card and three of them on another card and give me a reason why you divided them up, it's very similar, very simple what you do. You take the French and the Italians and the Spanish, whichever ones I said, put them on one card, and the Tibetans, the Chechens, and the Basques, and put them on a different card. And if I asked you why, you'd say very simply, these three have countries, and these three don't have countries. And that would be right. But you'd be missing the point. The point would be, these three actually help determine what direction the world takes. These three watch over their shoulder to see what history will do to them next. That's what it means to be a Tibetan. You don't determine anything. What will happen to you is what somebody else determines what will happen to you. And the same thing if you're a Basque or a Chechenian, for that matter, even an Armenian, even though the Armenians sort of have Armenia back these days, or a Kurd. There's a Kurdistan, but most in other words, there are peoples that don't anymore say much about what happens to them. And there are peoples that, while they don't control the world, obviously, at least determine what happens to them and have a tremendous say about what goes on in history in general and what happens to them. The Jews were formerly in the Chechenian, Tibetan, and Basque category. What changed the Jew from Tibetan and Chechenian and Basque to French, Italian, and Spanish, whatever it was that I mentioned, was the state of Israel. We don't control everything, obviously. We're one tiny little country. But we at least, first of all, determine what happens to us. And second of all, we're part of the conversation. Perfect example of that is the UN in September. It didn't happen. Now, it may still happen. And some of you may be in favor of it, and some of you may be against it. Doesn't matter. Israel was against it. And it didn't happen. And it didn't happen, by the way, in a setting in which everybody knows Israel does not usually win the day. Israel, the United Nations is not one of those settings where you can say, oh, Israel controls that. You can say it about a lot of things, maybe, and you'd be wrong, but you can't even say it about the United Nations. But it didn't happen because a serious conversation ensued about what a country should have to do before it's given formal sovereignty. And while there's been no formal decision yet, it at least hasn't happened nearly as fast as some people thought and other people hoped it was going to happen. It's a perfect example of how even a small country without a lot of power in a certain setting can actually be a player. Now, a fourth thing is this. Peoples, real peoples, I don't mean a group of people, but a people, the Chinese, the Japanese, the Mongolians, the Kurds, peoples, that have rich traditions. Among many other things, they have a language. And you cannot imagine Russian culture without the Russian language. There'd be no Dostoevsky. And I don't speak Russian, and I don't read Russian, but I know that when I read Dostoevsky in English, I'm reading a very faint version of what the original must have been. Bialik, who we mentioned before, put it really beautifully. He said, reading any great work of literature in translation is like kissing the bride through the veil. In other words, is it a kiss? Yes. Is it what dreams are made of? No. And so each tradition and each heritage and each culture in its own language has richness. Because, by the way, languages are not exclusively instrumental. They're not how you go into a restaurant and ask for a glass of water. They say similar things in very different kind of ways. I'll give you just one example. In English, I say, I fell in love with her. Right? It implies, you know, some enchanted evening, you may see a stranger, blah, blah, blah. You take one look at her, oh my God, your heart leaps out, and then you're sort of going head over heels, falling down the hill, and you're totally out of control. Okay. That's a nice image. Depending what's at the bottom of the hill, but yeah, it's a nice image. In Hebrew, we say, hit ahavti ba, which literally means, I came to love myself through her. It's a very different conception of love. The Second World War destroyed what had been the Jewish language, which was Yiddish. Okay, now Yiddish is an artifact. But Hebrew was reborn in the place of Yiddish. And Hebrew would not have been born without the state of Israel. There are almost as many Jews in America as there are in Israel. It appears that the balance has actually shifted and that Israel has now got the largest Jewish community in the world. But it's only slightly bigger than America, if it is at all. But the number of Jews in America who speak Hebrew fluently, who are not from Israel, could fit in this building, literally, without exaggeration. And 150 years ago, this is also not an exaggeration, you could have fit every person in the world who spoke Hebrew into this building. Zionism, again, as a kind of a defiant revolutionary movement, said to history, we can change you. You are a powerful stream, but you're not a mighty river. And we can change you. And if it looked like in 1946, and we're doing our thought experiment, that there's going to be no Jewish language because Yiddish is gone and Hebrew's barely sputtering along, well, by 2011, pilots speak to control towers in Hebrew. And surgeons and nurses do operations in Hebrew. On the first day of the Intifada, in September 2000, I actually ended up driving myself on Shabbat, on Rosh Hashanah, to the hospital for an emergency appendectomy. And it's okay, I'm fine. You know, where were you then? Now they're going, oh my God, it's terrible. You know, when I'm in the hospital with all the IVs and none of you called, right? Of course, it was Yontif, but that's beside the point. But now, 11 years later, whatever, you know, oh, I'm so sorry. Okay, whatever. Thanks. I thought it was like Nebraska kindness or something, you know? You're supposed to hear, oh my God, Gordis is in the hospital. You get on a plane, you go, you bring flowers, you bring chocolate. Anyway. So I drive myself to the hospital. It's not a lot of traffic. It's Shabbos and Rosh Hashanah. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, if I am not sick, how am I ever going to get back home? Please, God, let me be sick. You know, so God answers prayers. So, you know, I go in there, and they take some blood work. It doesn't look so good. Then you work your way up the food chain. You know, there's a person who's like 15 years old wearing a white coat. Then you get an 18-year-old with a stethoscope. Then you get finally a 22-year-old guy who looks like he's starting to shave. And then finally it says, professor. You say, oh, yeah, I'm sick. All right, yeah. Okay, and then they say, okay, you're having, you know, you're going to have an emergency appendectomy. I said, fine, that's cool. You know, my mother-in-law's over. Take your time, whatever. So I go in, there's four of us at this little play, me, the star role, lying there in a white sheet on the bed. And there's a Russian surgeon and a Haredi, ultra-Orthodox OR nurse, and an Arab anesthesiologist. All of us speaking Hebrew, from America, from Russia, an Arab, and a Haredi woman whose language at home I'm sure is Yiddish. And we're all speaking Hebrew. It's pretty amazing. What was not so amazing is that the Arab anesthesiologist said to me, "Kamata shokel? How much do you weigh?" And that's a fair question for an anesthesiologist to ask you. And I told him how many pounds I weighed, and he said, "I don't know pounds. How many kilo do you weigh?" And I'm like, "I don't know. Divide by 2.2. And the last words that I heard as I saw the mask descend were, "Lo noran de nachesh. No worry about it. We'll guess." Huh? Right? And I'm thinking, oh, my God. But anyway, I'm here, so he either divided or guessed well. But in any event, but when you have an Arab, an ultra-Orthodox nurse, and a surgeon from Russia, and a young guy from America, all speaking Hebrew in an OR at Hadassah Hospital, it's an extraordinary thing. It's an extraordinary thing. Because not one of them grew up in a home that spoke Hebrew. And every single one of them understood that the lingua franca of this Jewish country is not going to be Arabic, which was the language of the land. It wasn't going to be Yiddish, which a lot of Jews still spoke back then. It wasn't going to be English, even though it had been a British colony. It was going to be Hebrew. It was going to be the language that the Jews spoke in the time of Joshua and the Judges when they first came to the land. Even Hebrew was an act of defiance. Even Hebrew was an act of rebirth. Even Hebrew was a way of saying, in this country, we are going to speak the language that we spoke the last time we were a sovereign people. It is the only language that none of us speak, but we're going to speak it. It's an extraordinary accomplishment. And you would not have Hebrew if you did not have a sovereign Jewish state. So there is, just to remind you, There is this notion of restoring hope. There is this notion of creating the new Jew. There is this notion of restoring Israel to the family of nations. There is this notion of restoring Hebrew and all of the other cultural things. I remember that we were driving once in the back. We were driving with our, you know, family road trip. Everybody loves those, right? You remember them as being great, and you plan for them as being great. The only time that they're not great is when you're actually doing them, right? I mean, really, if you just took notes about this, you would say, never again. But it's kind of like, you know, childbirth. You just say, oh, that was great. Let's have another one. So in any event, we're there driving along the Jordan Valley River. Isn't it cool, children? Israel on this side, Jordan on that side, a pretty little river. You know, look at all the... Whatever, and they're in the back with their headphones, you know, right? They could have been in their room. Why are we driving? Gas is $10 a gallon, and they're going like, okay, whatever. So finally, we keep saying, look outside. And finally, one of them, my son, the one who's in the army now, looks outside and sees a green sign that says Gilgal, and it's got an arrow pointing left. And oh my God, he looks and he speaks, and he says, is that Gilgal the same Gilgal that I just learned about in Bible class in school in the book of Samuel? And we said, yes, that is exactly the same Gilgal, which is why you live here. No, in all seriousness, because I will say something that will rub you the wrong way. But when I was in Mrs. Brown's 7th grade social studies class, and she taught us American history, she taught us Plymouth Rock and the Mayflower, George Washington crossing the Delaware, eventually the Alamo, etc., etc. She was a very, very wonderful woman, Protestant, who had marched with King. I mean, I knew her in 7th grade as the scariest teacher I'd ever seen in my life. But I learned later on in life she was a very impressive woman. But here's what I knew even as a 7th grader. The Mayflower and Plymouth Rock were not my story. She wanted us to believe that they were, and most of my classmates believe that they were. And when I tell this to people, they get really annoyed. But I felt, as a 7th grader, it wasn't my story. That's what I felt. And that, I think, is the reason that I live in Israel, by the way. The real reason that I live in Israel is because in 1999, we'd gone for a sabbatical, and my wife said, I want to stay. And I said, I don't. So we compromised, and we did. But on a certain real level... Now, that's actually 100% true, and the few people in this room who know my wife know how true it is. But in any event, I knew that my great-great-great-great-great-grandparents wouldn't have been allowed on the Mayflower. That was the real truth. And when I moved to California in 1984 and started working as a rabbi, and I met people at the Jewish Home for the Aging and some of the more elderly members of my congregation, more than a few of them told me a version of the same story. Now, they were very old at this point. But then when they had gotten to America at the turn of the century, of the previous century, the beginning of the 1900s, and they had come from Europe, and they'd already had a sibling here who was awaiting them, and they'd brought, and you know, they had a little carry-on pack, what you and I would call a carry-on, that was everything they had in the world. And they brought either silver candlesticks, or a pair of tefillin, or something. I cannot tell you how many people told me, my brother greeted me at the bottom of the gangplank thing, he saw what I was carrying, and he took that bundle, and he dropped it into the water. And he said, that was for the old country. You're in America now. We gave up stuff to make it here. Let's not deny it. We gave up stuff. Most people in this room cannot tell me the difference between a Mishnah and a Midrash. And most people in this room don't speak Hebrew. And most people in this room can't find a story if I mention the burning bush. Well, that's easy. But I don't know. Korach. Find it. Most people here can't tell me what the last book of the Bible's about. These are things that people knew back then. We made profound accommodations to make it here. Some of them we're trying to recoup. Some of them we never can. But there is a thing about being in the backseat of the car with your parents yelling at you to take off your headphones and looking off and sing Gilgal and sing that the place where you're seeing out the window is exactly the place that you learned about in Bible class 3 or 4 days ago. It is about being home. And just like you and me, in a way that we're able to let our hair down at home and behave in ways that we wouldn't behave out in the public, Jews at home behave in ways that we behave at home, not always to our great credit. there is still a great power to being at home. And I could go on. But I want to leave some time to talk about what some of the great dangers facing Israel are. So I want to summarize here and say to you that what I think Israel is about, it's not about the Palestinians. It's not about settlements. It's not about high tech. It's about changing the existential condition of the Jewish people. In every way. Hope, peoplehood, a new kind of Jew, joining the family of nations, what it means to be a Jew in 2011 is entirely different from what it meant to be a Jew in 1911. Entirely different. And it's all because of the state of Israel, even in Omaha, Nebraska. And so if somebody asks you, what's it worth? Well, the question is really, what's the future of the Jewish people worth? Because the answer to that question, what, 2,000 years you survived, and now 63 years later you can't go back to it? No, you actually can't go back to it. I mean, there would be Jews. But we would be a faint shadow of who we were. There are still Armenians, but the Turks won. They destroyed them. They're Kurds. So, we'd be like the Armenians. There'd be some Jews. And the last time I was in the Knesset a few weeks ago, maybe more, I don't know, a few months ago, I was in the Knesset. It was the Armenian something or other day, and there's all these Armenian priests walking around with their big, you know, their robes and their hats and their whatever, talking to various Knesset members, trying to get Israel to recognize Armenian this, Armenian that. That's what we'd do. We'd float around the globe trying to get people to remember, oh, the Holocaust and when we lost the state of Israel. Yeah, that'd be our new thing. Would there be Jews? Yes. Would Jewish life anywhere, including in Omaha, Nebraska, be anything like it is now? No. So if somebody tells you to take out that index card or take out that iPhone or take out that BlackBerry and write what this is about, you don't need to mention the conflict. You don't need to mention Iran. You need to talk about what's happened to the Jewish people. That's why it matters that Israel survived. If you care about the future of the Jewish people, then you need to care about the Jewish state. Now I want to say something about the conflict. Then I want to say something about loyalty, and then I'll stop. And they will be obviously much, much shorter. The conflict is a terrible thing. Conflict is a horrible thing. And I want you to understand, wherever you are politically, that there are very, very, very few Israelis. There are some. I don't want to deny it. But there are very, very, very few Israelis who don't want the conflict over as fast as it can be made to be over. Because I will tell you this. You don't need to have many of the following incidences just to know that this is just not bearable for the long run. You have a son in a unit that is beyond description, so I won't describe it. And then one night, you're just about to fall asleep. You're like, you're sort of like in that la-la land when you're not quite sleeping, but you're not really awake anymore. And the phone rings. And your wife says, get it. So I get it. And it's him. And he said, hi, it's me. And I said, hi. And he said, I'm just calling to tell you I'm going out tonight. That does not mean I have a date. So you see, the only two things that make any sense whatsoever, you say, I love you, and be very careful. And then you hang up. And your wife says to you, who was it? Oh, it was Avigdor Lieberman. I always say I love you to Avigdor Lieberman. I mean, he's so, like, cuddly, you know? Who do you think it was? What did he want? And then you say nothing. You just called to say hi. Because you're not going to tell her what he just said. But she heard you say, be careful. So she knows you lied. So she goes to sleep knowing that the last thing you said to her that day was a bold-faced lie. And you go to sleep knowing that she went to sleep knowing that the last thing you said was a bald-faced lie. And you agree with each other to lie. You have a bad dream in the middle of the night, you can wake each other up, unless it was about him. That you don't tell. Because I have those nights, she has those nights, we don't need to both have both of those sets of nights. And then you think you go to sleep, but you don't actually go to sleep. You wait for the sun to come up because you know nothing really about what he does, but you figure if he's going out at night, it must be a night thing. So it must be over when the sun comes up. It's amazing how slowly the clock can turn. And then at 5:30 in the morning, you still haven't heard from him, but it's time to go to shul because weekday morning minyan is at 6. So you put on a pair of jeans and a t-shirt and you walk outside, phone in the back pocket, talis and tefillin in your hand, and you're walking down the streets of Jerusalem and the sun is barely creeping over the top of the houses and there's this kind of reddish glint on the stones. And you're sort of wandering on your own thoughts, and then you feel a buzz. So you know it's a text. And you take your phone out of your back pocket, and there's three words. Chazarnu hakol tov. We're back. Everything's fine. And you really just want to sit down on the curb and cry. Because when he was 9 years old, you decided to live out some ideological moment of fancy, and he now pays the price. And you're exhausted. But you got other kids, and you got a job, and you got a wife, and you got to live. Because he could call tonight also and say, I'm just calling to tell you I'm going out. And he's in the army for 7 years. And at that point, only two were done. So I tell you that story only by way of saying that even Israelis who may sound like hardliners are just trying to stay alive. That's their read. Now, you can think they're wrong. You can think they should make many more accommodations. That's a fair position too. They may think it's right. They may think it's wrong. But you should not conflate their being hardliner on compromise with not desperately wanting the conflict to be over. The vast majority of Israelis, for exactly the reasons that I just told you about, because every Israeli family goes through that. Not every, but most do, want this over. You need to understand that. So the conflict with the Palestinians is going to go hot and cold and hot and cold and hard and easy and good and bad for as long as the eye can see. I promise you, it is not going to be over in the lifetime of anybody in this room. It's not. Because it's going to be over the day that the Palestinians recognize Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state with secure borders and end the conflict. Everybody knows more or less what the map is going to be. Everybody knows more or less what 90% of the resolution of the issues is going to be. The issue is not going to rise or fall on the unresolved 10%. It is just not going to be over until the Palestinians decide that the conflict is over. But I want to remind you that while the thing was raging at the UN, while it was raging, and the momentum looked like it was going in Abbas's direction, and he had everything to lose by doing anything but keeping his mouth shut, he came out and pointed out that Palestinians living in refugee camps on the West Bank, in what will, he said, soon be Palestine, those Palestinians in refugees on the in refugee camps on the West Bank are not going to be made citizens of Palestine. No, no. They are going to remain citizenless because they have to be repatriated to Israel. In other words, Palestine is not about finally putting an end to the suffering of the Palestinian people. Palestine is about creating a state for the Palestinians and continuing to wage a battle against the viability of a sovereign Jewish state next door. That's why the Palestinian refugees, which numbered some 700,000 in 1948, have never been made citizens of Syria, Lebanon, or Jordan, and now number several million, whereas the same number, 700,000 Jews, were kicked out of Arab lands and went to an Israel that had no money, no food, no nothing, no shelter. And every single solitary one was made a citizen. Well, no. Fairly, no. Was there all sorts of discrimination against them? Yes. Are they all citizens? Do they all get health care? Are their children and grandchildren now professors at Hebrew University? Yes. Because for us, the goal was to make a country and bring the Jews into it. And that Palestinian utterance just 2 months ago, that even Palestinians living smack in the middle of what's going to be Palestine, he says, there are not going to be Palestinian citizens. They have to go back there. It's more important to stick it to Israel, forgive my French, than to build a Palestinian state. With that attitude, the conflict is never going to end. And here's what we know. As long as the conflict rages, they're going to kill some of us, and we're going to kill some of them. And you're not going to like it. And that's too bad. Because we're in this for as long as it takes. Because what I tried to explain to you for most of the lecture is that what's at stake here is not our national orchestra or our flag or our borders or the pretty postcards that you buy in Jerusalem. It's the future of the Jewish people. We're not going to give up on that. So it can make American Jews uncomfortable. It can make American non-Jews uncomfortable. That's fine. The prophets were in the business of making people uncomfortable. Seriously, why is comfort a value? Why is comfort a value? So there's Hezbollah, there's Islamic Jihad, there's Hamas, there's Fatah, there's all that. Well, there'll be better days, there'll be worse days. They'll kidnap soldiers, we'll try to get them back. It'll come and it'll go. But we're in this for as long as it takes. It's not going to bring down Israel. There's just no way it's going to bring down Israel. Terrorism cannot destroy a country. It can hurt its economy, it can make its citizens scared, it can make people very angry. It can't destroy a country. Iran, though, is a different ballgame. And the reason that Iran is a different ballgame is not because if they fire a nuclear weapon that Israel could really be a very bad day. It would be a pretty bad day. But the reason is different. The minute Iran gets a bomb, if it doesn't have it yet, then part of the Zionist promise that I tried to describe to you is undone. Because the Zionist promise is we take care of ourselves. So if you sit at the edge of your child's bed and you sing them the Shema and you read them a story, and just like in America, you know, make sure that all three stuffed animals are on the bed and the nightlight is on and the door is open 34.258 degrees, etc., etc., etc. Same exact thing. They even have good night moon in Hebrew. You'll be happy to know. But you say to your child, I'll see you in the morning. Now, in 2011, you say that, and you know that that's true. Because that kid's uncle or father or older sister's boyfriend or somebody, not too many degrees of separation, is out there that night. In the air, on the sea, and on land, all over, to make sure that that mother or father and that kid will see each other in the morning. But if Iran gets the bomb, all the kids in the air and all the kids in the sea and all the kids in land, nothing we can do. We can strike back. We have nuclear weapons. Some of them are on submarines. They'll get clobbered. But that mother and kids still won't see each other in the morning if they're in the wrong city. I'll see you in the morning really means I'll see you in the morning as long as Ahmadinejad doesn't decide that I shouldn't see you in the morning, which is exactly the boy in the Warsaw Ghetto. A victim on call. He's not dead. He'll be dead when the Nazi decides he should be dead. And the whole point of the State of Israel was to change that. Which is why I suggest to you that the one thing that Ehud Barak and Bibi and Tzipi and Livnat, but all four of them, agree with each other about is not on my watch. Bibi is not going to let Iran get a bomb on his watch. And Tzipi would not have let Iran get a bomb on her watch. And Ehud Barak is not going to let Iran get a bomb if he's ever reelected or while he's defense minister. Because it's not about, gee, they have a faster plane. It's not like giving Saudi Arabia an F-35. It's about changing the whole ballgame. It's about going back to being victims on call. This is my read. And now, therefore, why are Bibi and Barak arguing about this on the front page of Haaretz? They know that Ahmadinejad understands what they're saying. It is not for Ahmadinejad and it is not for Israel. It is for the West. It is for you, actually, and your president, to understand we're not going to let it happen. It hasn't been 500 years since 1938. And it hasn't been 250 years since 1938. And it hasn't been 100 years since 1938. It hasn't even been 75 years since the end of the war. We are not going to let it happen. Because he says explicitly that Israel needs to be wiped out. And he says explicitly that he's getting a weapon. And the West is sitting on its hands, doing absolutely nothing. So this little conversation on the front page of Haaretz is simply to let all of you and your congresswomen and your congressmen and your senators and your president know that's not going to happen. And if and when the day comes that Israel actually has to do something dramatic, hopefully it'll work. Hopefully the second strike will not be terrible, although it will be bad. And hopefully we'll make it. But also hopefully everybody in this country will understand that it is the failure of the United States that led to that strike. And not a Barack Obama. Forget Barack Obama. George Bush had a gigantic army right there and didn't do anything about it. George Bush refused to sell Israel the bunker buster bombs that it asked for so that they could kind of try to drill down and take care of it. It's actually one of those non-sectarian, non-partisan issues. The United States has failed in its role as a defender of democracy and peace. Simply has. It attacked Iraq, got the first three letters right. But spelling counts. Now I want to say one last thing about loyalty. This mostly goes towards the Jews in our midst, but not only. I'm not one of those people who thinks that any one of us, not me, not you, not anybody else outside, has a monopoly on insight and truth. A lot of what I believe might prove to be wrong. A lot of my positions might prove to be faulty. And I think that the Jewish tent ought to be a very big tent. And that we ought to learn how to live in a community that disagrees strongly about all sorts of issues. Otherwise, we're not going to survive. Just give you one little vignette. When Yud Lamed Peretz, the well-known Yiddish author, died in Warsaw, a century ago, give or take, 100,000 people came to his funeral in Warsaw. 100,000 people. And they didn't get tweets. And they included Haredim and Bundists and Enlightenment Jews, Haskalah Jews, and non-enlightened Jews, and observant Jews, and secular Jews, and this kind of, everybody in the Jewish community from all walks of life came out. And I suggest to you that there's not a figure in the Jewish world alive anywhere who would evoke that kind of outpouring of loss or grief. It wasn't grief. There's nobody. There are rabbis, and hundreds of thousands would come out, but from one sector. But you can't think of it. I mean, maybe the closest would be like, God forbid he should live to 120, but Elie Wiesel. But the Haredi community wouldn't come out for Elie Wiesel. We have nobody in the Jewish world who would evoke by their mere passing away that kind of communal loss. We are a horribly divided people. And we cannot survive as a horribly divided people. And therefore, the question that we have to ask ourselves when it comes to our position about Israel is not, how do I convince that Shmendrick that I'm right? The question is, what is he saying that I need to hear? In what way does he have a truth that my position does not embody? So if I'm on the right and he's on the left, then I have to ask, well, let's say the other way around first, right? If I'm on the left and he's on the right, then I got to ask myself, in what way is his worry about Israel's security more realistic than mine? Right? In what way does my saying Israel should go back to the 1967 borders? Of course, that really actually does put Gordas' house in range of Qassam's. It actually does. But I really hope it'll be okay. Maybe hope isn't just good enough for me. Maybe hope that they won't hit the runway of Ben Gurion Airport, which would then be in Qassam range, just isn't good enough. So if I'm on the left and I want a big, you know, kumbaya party out in the Judean desert, I'm going to wear my kippah and he's going to wear his keffiyeh and we're going to, you know, have kosher over here and halal over here. It's going to be like sababa, as they say. Great. But like, what if I'm wrong? What if we give it all back and it turns into Gaza again? And vice versa. If I'm on the right and he's on the left and I'm absolutely convinced that I've got the security thing down and he's completely naive, I ask myself, what's the moral cost of my confidence? Has my hard-nosedness, which may be security necessary, calloused me in my view of our enemies? Have I stopped seeing them as human beings? Not the terrorists, they're barely human. But the decent ones out there, and there are some. perhaps a lot. Have I become sort of just kind of treating this like a football game, and as more as my team scores, the better, and their team shouldn't score anything, and a shutout would be great? I mean, have I lost sight of the subtleties, the moral nuances of this conflict? And if I have, what am I going to do to retain my hard-nosedness about Israel's security needs and try to recoup something of the moral values that I think my tradition has tried to bespeak for 2,000 years, 3,000 years, 4,000 years, depending on who you count? So I close with this. I think that what we have to ask in this Jewish tent of discourse, and frankly, I would say non-Jews as well, criticism of Israel is 100% legitimate, as long as it includes the following three ingredients. It has to be committed to Israel's security, and it has to be committed to Israel as a democratic and Jewish state. If your position is committed to Israel's security, Jewishness, and democracy, then I might disagree with you about a lot of things, but I think your position is completely legit. Maybe wrong, but it's legitimate. But if you give up on Israel's Jewishness, and especially if you give up on Israel's security, then what I have to say, because of what I tried to do in the majority of lectures, say you are not opposing my political view. You are opposing the survivability of my people. And you may wear a kippah, but you're then my enemy. It's just that simple, because the stakes are too high. So the stakes are too high to be too easily divided. Let's broaden the tent and bring in everybody who's committed to Israel's security, Jewishness, and democracy. But because the stakes are so high that it's the Jewish people that's at stake, let's not pretend that the people who are our enemies are not our enemies. And I don't care if they wear tzitzis, and I don't care if they wear kippot, or if they wear crucifixes or hijabs. I don't care. It's irrelevant what religion they are. It's irrelevant what political party they are. It's irrelevant what their persuasion of any sort is. If they are not committed to the survival and the Jewishness and the democracy of the only state the Jewish people has had for 2,000 years, then what they are fundamentally is foes of the Jewish people. And you stay alive first and foremost by knowing who your enemies are. Our challenge, it seems to me, is to broaden our tent as much as we possibly can, to have the kinds of conversations that I hope I elicited a little bit tonight about what Israel's about, what matters about Israel, how Israel has changed the course of Jewish history. And if we do that, and if we do that being very vigilant for Israel's security, democracy, and Jewishness, then I think, to go back to our little thought experiment about January 1948, we will one day be able to look back and say that it was our generation that guaranteed that ultimately the greatest days of the Jewish people lay not in the past, but in a glorious future still ahead. Thanks very much.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Daniel Gordas, president of the Shalem Foundation in New York City and senior fellow at the Shalem Center in Jerusalem, as well as the author of Saving Israel, How the Jewish People Can Win a War That May Never End. He spoke on the topic, The Year 2048, Can Israel Survive to the Age of 100? Dr. Gordas' remarks were given as part of the Ruth and Phil Sokoloff Lecture Series. His appearance was co-sponsored by the Natan and Hanna Schwab Center for Israel and Jewish Studies. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, November 16, 2011, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Caroline Gillen of the Schwab Center for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.